It is Tuesday, July 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Israel's military downs a Syrian warplane. We look at the rising tensions between the presidents of the United States and Iran. And scientists believe fog may help quench the world's thirst. It's all ahead. The Israeli military said it shot down a Syrian warplane Tuesday after it entered Israeli airspace. Israeli military spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus said the Syrian Sukhoi fighter jet approached Israel at a relatively high speed before the Israeli military fired two Patriot interceptor missiles at the jet after it entered Israeli territory. But Syrian state media reported the warplane was fired on as it participated in operations against rebels in Syrian territory. Earlier this week, the Syrian government condemned the Israeli evacuation of White Helmet rescue workers from southern Syria. Ofer Zaltzberg is the International Crisis Group senior analyst for Israel. Speaking from Jerusalem, he tells me what's known about the downing of the Syrian plane.
There is currently a campaign of the Syrian army with the Russian support to retake the southwest of Syria, immediately next to the Israeli-Syrian fence, and specifically that in the area that is being ruled by a group called Jesh Halet, which is affiliated with Islamic State, there is an aerial campaign there, Syrian airplanes, mostly some Russian ones. It seems like this Sukhoi, at least Russian-made, are involved in bombarding the area before retaking it. And these airplanes are operating just next to the occupied Golan Heights, an area that is ruled by Israel and controlled aerially by Israel. And it seems that this Syrian airplane crossed the line, the armistice line, and Israel's Patriot missile took it down.
Has there been any response from Syria following this?
I've seen rhetorical responses, condemnations of this shooting down, but I haven't seen so far more than that.
What is the situation currently like in the southwest of Syria?
There is what is called a de-escalation zone since last July, created in an agreement with three guarantors, Russia, the U.S., and Jordan. And this is one of four de-escalation zones. And what we are seeing now is that the Syrian government is retaking them one by one. It already has retaken the eastern part of this de-escalation zone 2 weeks ago, and now is the part of Deraa city, and now is doing the same in the western one. The situation, therefore, is one of fighting and recuperating from this fighting. The dust slowly settles in. The preference of Damascus and Moscow was for the retaking to occur through reconciliations, they call it. The opposition usually refers to these as a surrender deal, deals in which the opposition accepts the rule of Damascus. It's the return of the Syrian government to providing everything in these areas, all kinds of services and military control, and then some degree of integration of the rebels back into the state, local authorities and things of the sort. But the group of Jesh Halet, the Islamic State affiliated group, is not part of this preference because it is affiliated with Islamic State, is a terrorist organization, and their Syrian-Russian preference was indeed to eliminate them, in fact, militarily. And what we have seen with this airplane was a spillover incident of that fighting.
Over the last weekend, Israel evacuated hundreds of volunteer White Helmet rescue workers.
Yeah.
Now, apparently there were some, I guess there was some dispute over how many. I think originally they said there were 800 rescued. Then I heard later it was more like around 400, and then there were others still there. What is the latest on that?
So basically, these White Helmets have operated only in rebel-held areas, and at least according to Russia and the Syrian government, they were backed by Western intelligence agencies. Certainly, we see now that Western governments are keen on rescuing them from the fighting. They have been characterized by Damascus, by Moscow, as affiliated with Jabhat al-Nusra, one of the two most hawkish organizations in Syria. And basically, there was an arrangement for 800 of them to be rescued, to be allowed exit, and then Israel to facilitate their passing through Jordan to Western states. Only some 400 of them were able to do this, and then the rest was disrupted, and the reason for that is not fully clear. This is the reason for the gap in the numbers. And it seems that among the 800 were not only white helmets, but probably also some of the rebel leaders that the Western governments have supported in the past and feared that Assad will not integrate into the government, but will torture and execute. And we are now waiting to see whether there will be a way still to allow for the remaining few hundreds of this force to exit, if it's not through with Israel's help, then directly through Jordan, or whether they are trapped there and will need to fight with the Syrian army.
Ofer Zaltzberg, the International Crisis Group Senior Analyst for Israel, speaking from Jerusalem. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump says Russians will support the Democrats in the November congressional elections. Laos State News Agency says several hundred people were killed, but hundreds are missing in the collapse of a dam. Hundreds of children are apparently still separated from their parents at the U.S. border, and wildfires in Greece kill more than 70 people. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two scientists at the University of Michigan say that they have found evidence of one of the Milky Way's long-lost siblings. Richard D'Souza and Eric Bell, both with the University of Michigan's Department of Astronomy, determined that our neighboring galaxy, Andromeda, ripped apart and cannibalized a massive galaxy 2 billion years ago. The duo found that while most of this huge galaxy, called M32P, was ripped to shreds, it did leave behind a bit of evidence of its existence. D'Souza and Bell say the remains of the galactic sibling includes a nearly undetectable ring of stars that spans to a width larger than Andromeda itself. Before it was devoured, the M32P galaxy was considered the third largest member of the local group of galaxies behind the Milky Way and Andromeda. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, there is rising gun crime in Canada. We'll have more on that. The war of words between Iran and the U.S. continued Monday with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeting he's unimpressed with Sunday's threat by President Donald Trump. The American president warned Iran in a Twitter post never to threaten the U.S. or it would suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. Trump was responding to his Iranian counterpart, Hassan Rouhani, who over the weekend said conflict with Tehran would become the mother of all wars. Those comments followed the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran International Nuclear Agreement and the launching of a new campaign of speeches and online communications designed to encourage domestic unrest. Hussein Banai is an assistant professor in international affairs at Indiana University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the latest rhetoric represents a dangerous phase in bilateral tensions.
The danger here is that this could spill over into some sort of miscalculation. Actually, in the waters of the Persian Gulf, or in terms of Iran's behavior in other parts of the Middle East, or on the American side, some sort of a military overreach or overreaction to something that they might perceive hostile. But it, more importantly, I think it opens a door to third-party spoilers like Israel or Saudi Arabia to really seize this opportunity, as they see it, to really draw the Iranians or the Americans into open military conflict. So I think the rhetorical back and forth has really busted open the possibility of this actually materializing into real concrete conflagration between the two sides.
President Rouhani, in fact, told Iranian diplomats on the weekend that the hostile policies toward Tehran could lead to, quote, the mother of all wars.
Yes, and then he went on to say after that, but if we make peace, it will also be the mother of all peace. That part wasn't widely quoted in the media, but I think his point is one that, look, this is a country that sees itself very much put in a corner, and it will not succumb to any kind of pressure, especially rhetorical pressure from the United States, and especially out of this administration, which they feel has unjustly withdrawn from the nuclear accord and has put the Europeans in a tough spot too. So they have to demonstrate some sort of result.
A conflict, of course, would be costly on both sides. But doesn't the U.S. just have to wait for sanctions to begin to bite?
Yes. I mean, in Secretary Pompeo's speech yesterday, in fact, he highlighted this, saying with a great deal of pride that Iran's oil exports will basically freeze up by November 1st. And that would really put the pinch on the Iranian economy, which is in terrible shape already because of all this rhetorical back and forth and because of the lack of trust by European companies and Western firms in terms of foreign investments in Iran's economy. So that could really destabilize Iran. And I think the rhetoric is a kind of the prelude to all that.
The Pompeo speech at the Reagan Library Sunday night was part of a Trump administration offensive of speeches and online communications meant to foment unrest. But in fact, is this not uniting Iran?
It is. And I think actually the administration is aware of that as well. I think the intention here is to demonstrate that the United States, if it wishes, it could politically destabilize Iran. But that really, in a way, is the front show for what is really going on, which is to really make sure that Iran's tough economic situation worsens and that the United States opening the dialogue with the Iranian opposition groups in the diaspora, the Iranian government would reorient its actions or concede in terms of its nuclear program into some sort of a new deal with the United States.
Hussein Banai of Indiana University. In remarks Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said reconciliation with Iran, like that underway with North Korea, is possible if Tehran undertakes what he called demonstrable, tangible, irreversible changes. The family of the man accused of killing two people and wounding 13 others in a shooting spree on a street in Toronto, Canada, says he suffered from mental illness. Authorities have identified the suspect as 29-year-old Faisal Hussein of Toronto, who also died in the attack. They say he killed a 10-year-old girl and an 18-year-old woman Sunday night in the city's Greektown neighborhood. Hussein's family issued a statement Monday saying they're devastated by the incomprehensible news that he was responsible for the shootings and that he had dealt with psychosis and depression. Police are still working to determine a possible motive for the attack and say they've not ruled out any possibilities. Toronto Mayor John Tory said the shooting was evidence of a gun problem in Toronto. Wendy Sukir is a professor at Toronto's Ryerson University and the president of Canada's Coalition for Gun Control. She speaks with me about Canada's gun crime.
For the last 4 years, there's been a steady increase in murders with guns, suicides with guns, gun theft, shootings, not just in Toronto, but across the country.
Is it known where these guns are coming from?
So the last data that we have from Toronto and also a study from BC suggests for the first time in many years, at least half of the guns recovered in crime are originating in Canada rather than being smuggled in from the United States. And that represents a change because historically, at least two-thirds of handguns that were traced back to the U.S. We would tie that to the relaxation of Canada's gun control laws in recent years.
That is interesting because one person I spoke to yesterday, he was saying that the guns largely were coming from the United States and because of the U.S., the Second Amendment situation.
Well, the U.S. has almost as many guns as people, and it's a major source of illegal guns worldwide. But in this last round of shootings, the chief of police for Toronto has repeatedly said that their traces are showing many more guns originating in Canada. I mean, last year alone, we had almost 7,000 handguns reported stolen, and we're seeing straw purchases and other kinds of illegal sales. You know, the number of restricted and prohibited weapons in Canada, handguns and assault weapons, has doubled in the last decade. There are more than a million now. They used to be restricted or prohibited, which meant they were really hard to get. and therefore harder to sell illegally or steal. But as you relax controls over legal guns, you increase the chances of diverting those guns to illegal markets or for them to be used by people who shouldn't have them.
How easy is it to purchase a gun, say, if that person has a mental health condition?
So in Canada, compared to the United States, the legislation is much stricter, and also it's national. It's not fragmented. So the problem with mental health issues is it's a bit random. Unless the police have been directly involved in taking someone to the hospital or because of some kind of altercation associated with mental illness, whether or not that is turned up in the screening process will depend on whether or not the references are aware of it and answer truthfully, whether or not the applicant answers truthfully, whether or not the police have undertaken secondary checks. And there are cases we know of where people have checked the box that says, I've had a mental health issue. They've still been issued a license, and the results have been horrific.
Wendy Soukier, the president of Canada's Coalition for Gun Control. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Two-thirds of the world's population currently lives with water shortages at least part of the year. That's according to one estimate. And climate change and growing populations are expected to stretch water supplies even further. Experts are looking for new ways to capture this precious resource. In some places, they're harvesting water from fog. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Rain is rare in Choapa Province, Chile, just south of the Atacama Desert. Just 50 millimeters fall per year on average. What they do get here is fog. With a decade-long drought straining the already limited water supply, these fog catchers are a salvation, says agricultural engineer Pedro Hernandez.
There are communities that don't have water availability, so the fog catcher allows them to have what they didn't have before for specific agricultural activities, etc.
As the fog drifts over the hills, these mesh nets capture droplets of water, which drip into a collector. They provide enough water to sustain a new olive grove. It has been a lifeline for farmer Ricardo Alvarez.
I think this is something beautiful that we were waiting for, because before we lived from goat livestock. They have been bad years, so the livestock doesn't give enough to live. The sons are migrating to the city for work, so we were looking to have an opportunity with olives, and this project appeared, and we have to go with it.
Alvarez says the olives provide a future for the next generation and could save his community. Scientists say these fog harvesters could work better. Most are made of mesh netting, says Virginia Tech engineer Jonathan Borico.
The problem with that is if the netting is too big, the drop would sail right through the holes. And if the netting is too small, the water gets clogged in the holes. So either way you lose, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Borico and colleagues have developed what they call a fog harp. It has no horizontal wires, nothing to get in the way as gravity pulls water droplets down. It captures three times more water than a mesh net. Another way to make the mesh work better? Zap it with electricity, says Massachusetts Institute of Technology engineer Kripa Varanasi.
The electrical force then fundamentally changes the way droplets move. Instead of following the wind streamlines, they now follow electrical field lines. And a much larger percentage of these droplets now gets captured.
When the current switches on, hardly any mist can get past the electrified mesh. Varanasi's main goal is to collect mist from power plant cooling towers. But in cities like Cape Town, South Africa, where water is literally running out, he says the technology is far cheaper than other options like desalination. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Thank you very much, Steve. Well, Japan has been hit by a deadly heat wave, and temperatures have risen to a record 41.1 degrees Celsius in the city of Kumagaya, which is about 70 kilometers north of the capital, Tokyo. With the exception of the northern island of Hokkaido, temperatures in most of Japan are at least 10 degrees higher than the average for this time of the year. Now, apparently, news reports say the scorching heat has killed more than 70 people just this month. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
DREAMS, an acronym that stands for Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored, and Safe, is an ambitious partnership to reduce HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women in sub-Saharan African countries. DREAMS is supported by the U.S. government through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. At a milestone event celebrating the DREAMS program held in Windhoek on July 16th, U.S. Ambassador to Namibia, Lisa Johnson, said, "All too often, girls' dreams are interrupted. Research shows a cycle of HIV infections between older men and younger women. When an HIV-positive older man has a relationship with a young woman, he infects her with HIV. She eventually then has a relationship with a young man of her own age, infecting him too. If he doesn't get tested and started on treatment, he in turn passes the virus on to other young women, continuing this vicious cycle." To break this cycle, Ambassador Johnson noted, girls and young women need support and solutions to reduce the likelihood that they will become infected with HIV in the first place. "This is where the DREAMS program comes in," she said. "DREAMS provides comprehensive solutions that go beyond traditional health services to address risk factors such as school dropout, social isolation, economic disadvantage, and gender-based violence. This approach has been highly successful because it takes what works in real life and applies it to the goal of keeping adolescent girls and young women HIV negative and on track to achieve their goals. Evidence shows that the DREAMS program works. In the first 10 African countries that have implemented DREAMS, most districts achieved a 25% to 40% decline or greater in new HIV diagnoses among adolescent girls and young women. Today," said Ambassador Johnson, "we are celebrating the first 1,400 girls enrolled in DREAMS in Namibia and the expansion of the program to a total of 5 districts in 3 regions." Ambassador Johnson thanked the participants, the partners, and the government of the Republic of Namibia for the success of the program. "The DREAMS program will strengthen the determination, resilience, and empowerment of Namibian adolescent girls and young women," she said. "While it cannot remove all the challenges from their paths, it can give these girls and young women the tools they need to overcome them."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.